Well, it's nearly Christmas. And when Christmas comes, of course, so do the endless requests for money that we have come to associate with this season of goodwill towards men. I think I must have received at least a dozen circulars from various charities just during the last 7 days, requesting me to contribute to everything from cancer research to donkey sanctuaries. And on the television, you can't get away from it too. Blue Peter are organising bring and buy sales for mobile eye hospitals. And the BBC generally hope to exceed all records with their children in need appeal. And when you go to the shops down in the centre of town, there are the faithful members of the Rotary Club once again, shaking their buckets hopefully at passing shoppers. Clearly everybody believes that Christmas is a time for giving. So what could be more appropriate than our series of studies in 2 Corinthians should bring us on this Advent Sunday to that very subject, Christian giving. Those of you who have been following our series will know that in earlier chapters, the apostle has been defending himself against a rival party at the church in Corinth. He's been quite concerned, hasn't he, lest their slanders should have undermined his reputation and influence in the church there. But as we were seeing last Sunday, his long-awaited reunion with Titus, of which he speaks in chapter 7, that had largely dispelled these anxieties, so much so that he can conclude chapter 7 with the words, "I have complete confidence in you." Well, now as we embark on chapters 8 and 9, we quickly realize why it was so important that Paul should feel confident in the Corinthians. In addition to all his missionary activity in Asia and Europe, he was organizing a fund, a charitable enterprise, and he was expecting the Corinthians to cough up quite a bit towards it. What precisely this charitable fund was isn't made clear in our passage, but I think it's quite certain that it is the same fund as Paul mentions many other places in the New Testament, and particularly in Romans chapter 15, where we read, "I am on my way to Jerusalem, for the churches in Macedonia and Achaia," those are the 2 provinces of Greece, Corinth being in Achaia, "Macedonia and Achaia," he says, "have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the Christians there in Jerusalem." The church in Jerusalem had in fact been victim to poverty right from its beginning, partly no doubt as a result of the hostility of the Jewish populace there, and partly as a result of a famine that we read about in the book of Acts. Paul seems to have felt a special obligation to try and relieve this need in Jerusalem. In fact, he tells us in Galatians that the last time he was there in Jerusalem, he actually promised Peter that he would do everything he could to help the poor Christians there with funds from the Gentile churches. Now, the most obvious source for such benevolent funds were the churches of Greece, Achaia and Macedonia, and particularly those wealthy urban centres in Achaia, churches like Corinth, for instance. And to give them their due, judging from verse 10 of chapter 8, early signs were that the Corinthians responded very well to Paul's charitable appeal for this fund. He says they were not only the first church to make a contribution, they also entered a kind of covenant, pledging further money in future. "You not only were the first to give," he says, "but also the first to have the desire to continue to do so." Indeed, when we read 1 Corinthians chapter 16, the last chapter of Paul's previous letter to the Corinthians, we find him giving instruction there to the church in Corinth about how they were to take a collection for this relief fund every Sunday, and they were to gather together the monies thus obtained so that a good-sized lump would be on deposit and available the moment Paul arrived, wishing to take it to Jerusalem. Well, unfortunately, it seems that in the 12 months since the launch of the fund, this initial enthusiasm on the part of the Corinthians had waned. Perhaps it was the undermining influence of that anti-Pauline rival faction that we've talked about so much that did it. Anyway, reading between the lines a little, I think it's clear that Paul was entertaining some anxiety lest his much publicized pledge that the Corinthians had made to this fund was going to fail to materialize. We read, for instance, in chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, "I know your eagerness to help, and I've been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year you have been ready, and your enthusiasm has stirred most of them to action. But I'm sending the brothers," that's a trio that he mentions in the previous verses, "I'm sending the brothers in order that our boasting about you in this matter should not prove hollow. but that you should be ready, as I said you would be. Paul didn't want either himself or the Corinthians embarrassed by discovering that the money they had promised wasn't ready on time. So, having been reassured by Titus that, generally speaking, the Corinthians still entertained great affection and support for him, he writes these two chapters and includes them in his letter, urging these Christians at Corinth, basically, to buck their ideas up about my famine relief fund. You've had over a year now, he says, and I'm anxious to finalize the accounts and get the money where it's needed. Indeed, you could say that in chapters 8 and 9 here in 2 Corinthians, Paul is really writing for us a model Christian begging letter. He's telling us why, as Christians, we should give. He's telling us why, as Christians, we should be sympathetic to those envelopes and those letters that come through our letterbox at this time of year, or to those buckets that are shaped under our noses. Let me summarize for you, under three headings, the reasons he gives. We can't look at every verse in detail in these two chapters, but we can analyze out, I think, three basic reasons why Paul tells us Christians should give, and especially at Christmas time. The first reason, he says, because giving is a mark of Christian discipleship. That's in chapter 8, verses 1 to 7. The second reason, he says, because giving is an expression of Christian unity. That's in chapter 8, verse 13, and it comes up a number of other places in the remainder of our study passage. And the third reason he gives, Christians should give, he says, because of Christmas. Because of Christmas. And that really focuses on just two verses which are scattered in this passage, one at 8, verse 9, and the other at 9, verse 15. Well, that's the structure then for our study this morning. Let's look first at the first reason he gives for Christian giving, because it is a mark of Christian discipleship. Look at the first verses of chapter 8. Brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Now, every school teacher is aware that there's nothing that gets the best out of a group of children like a little good-natured competition with another class or school. And, in a sense, Paul is fostering just such gentle rivalry here. He was in Macedonia as he was writing this letter. That was the northern province of Greece. And their response, it seems, to his charitable appeal had been impressive. Places like Philippi and Thessalonica, they had really gone out of their way to give. Well, what better goad to encourage the Corinthians with then than a little loud praise for their country cousins up north? It's a bit like in Liverpool, praising Everton and things like that. We want you to know, brothers, he says, the generosity God has given to the Macedonians. The unspoken implication being, you don't want to be outdone by them, do you? Now, some of us may feel it was rather disreputable of the apostle to use this kind of tactic, a bit like emotional blackmail. Especially when he goes on rather more explicitly in verse 8 by saying, I want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. It's really a bit bald, isn't it? But I think in his defense, it has to be said that the Macedonian churches that he's using to challenge these Corinthians could scarcely have been perceived as a serious threat to Corinthian prestige, for they were much smaller, much less affluent congregations. Frankly, if wealthy Corinth couldn't raise more funds than Philippi and Thessalonica could, then they fully deserved to be made to feel humiliated. Just as indeed we deserve to be made to feel embarrassed when we hear the extraordinary generosity of some third world churches in Africa or in India or in Latin America compared with the meager tithe that we so often offer from our affluence. Now, he can hardly be called emotional blackmail when it is the gifts of the poor which are providing the moral leverage on the parsimoniousness of the rich. But there's no denying that in the case of the Macedonians, that moral leverage was pretty irresistible. See what he says about them. First of all, the sacrificial nature of their giving. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. I testify they gave as much as they were able, even beyond their ability, he says. Macedonia, at the best of times, was an exploited colonial economy. But on top of that, the Christians who lived there had to suffer a great deal of persecution. I imagine that many of the believers had been fined or dispossessed of their property because of their faith. So much so that Paul can say that their poverty was extreme. That's his word. Literally, we might translate it. It had hit rock bottom. That's the kind of expression he uses. And yet, you see, instead of using their lack of resources as an excuse for reducing their contribution, strangely, the Macedonian experience of want had had the effect of multiplying their liberality. They gave far beyond what could reasonably have been expected of them in their situation, says Paul. It was extraordinarily sacrificial. More than that, he says, it was also gratifyingly enthusiastic. Look at verse 3 again. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. Paul didn't have to twist their arm to get them to cough up the necessary. No, they had volunteered spontaneously to give. In fact, you detect the irony in verse 4. They begged, says Paul, they begged, but not for money to relieve their own poverty, as you might expect. No, they were begging for the opportunity to help, to relieve the poverty of others. They counted such an opportunity, he says, a privilege, literally a grace. It's a word he uses again and again for Christian giving. They really did believe what the Lord Jesus said, that it's more blessed to give than to receive. As far as they were concerned, they were the lucky ones. For in their book, it was the benefactors, not the beneficiaries, who were to be envied. Gratifyingly enthusiastic, then, their giving. But on top of all that, and most distinctive of all, Paul says it was also surprisingly spiritual. Look at verse 5. They did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then to us, in keeping with God's will. Perhaps Paul had expected a purely pragmatic response to his appeal. How much is in the budget, Mr. Treasurer? Are there any big bills to pay this month? How much can we afford? That sort of thing. But in fact, the Macedonian attitude was quite different, he said. It took him by surprise. Instead of the calculated thriftiness of an accountant, they had demonstrated the almost irrational extravagance of a lover. It wasn't just money they were contributing, says Paul. It was themselves. And it wasn't just the church in Jerusalem they gave it to. It was the Lord. Now, this was no frigid act of bureaucratic philanthropy. To use some lines of John O'Reilly, the Macedonians was no organized charity, scrimped and iced in the name of a cautious, statistical Christ. No, there was a warmth of personal consecration, suffusing the whole act of giving to them. Jesus wants us to do this for him, they said to one another. And it was that Christ-centered spirituality that motivated both the extravagance of their generosity and the cheerful willingness of it. Well, says Paul, that's how the churches here in Macedonia have given. And it's because we've been so encouraged by them that we're sending Titus back to you believers in Corinth with this letter in his hand and our request that you now make available to us the funds you've set apart for this important relief program. Let's prove to everybody, he says, that Corinth not only talks big when it comes to giving, but acts big too. After all, you've got a lot going for you at Corinth, he says. Compared with the Macedonian churches, you're bursting with talent and resources. Well, he says, just make sure that your ambition to be in the top league as far as preaching and evangelism and all that kind of thing goes, that in all of that you don't overlook this other vital aspect of Christian living. Just as you excel in everything, verse 7, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in complete earnestness, and in your love for us, see that you also excel in this grace of giving. Well, it doesn't take great expository gifts, I think, to see the very direct challenge those verses present to us here at Eden. Paul is right. If the Macedonian example ought to have been a spur to affluent first century Corinth, then how much more should it be a spur to affluent 20th century Cambridge? I fear for us also, giving is often the neglected grace in our Christian lives. How sacrificial is our giving, for instance? Does it cost us anything to give? I'm reminded of that famous story about the cow and the pig who were debating about which was the most generous. The cow pointed to all the pints of milk in the supermarket, representing its yearly milk yield. There, said the cow. Beat that, And the pig pointed to a side of bacon. All your milk, he says, just represents a contribution. What I give represents a sacrifice. Do we feel it? Do we actually miss it when we give? John Wesley learned as a young man that he could live on £28 a year. Of course, as he got older, his salary got larger. But he saw no reason to increase his standard of living. He lived perfectly adequately on £28 a year. So he just gave the surplus away. He continued living on £28 a year for the rest of his life. That meant often he gave away thousands of pounds in a year, just from the sale of his books alone. How sacrificial is our giving? Do we know anything about Macedonian generosity? And how enthusiastic is our giving, too? How cheerful is it? Is there a sort of resentment that comes across us sometimes when the offertory bag is put in front of us? Or those envelopes come through again from the Spastic Society or from the Missionary Society or whatever else it's from? There's a story I very much like, although I'm afraid some people here may not like it, about a Roman Catholic, a Pentecostalist, and a Scottish Presbyterian, who were all discussing with one another how they worked out how much to give. The Roman Catholic said, "Well, I asked my priest, and he told me to give a tenth, so that's what I do." The Pentecostalist says, "Well, I pray, and I ask the Holy Spirit to lead me, and then when he's led me, I decide how much to give on the basis of that." The Scottish Presbyterian said, "Well, it's like this. I put all my money in the offertory plate, and I throw it up in the air. And anything the Lord wants, he keeps." Well, my apologies to the Scots here for appearing to endorse what I'm sure is a wholly undeserved caricature. But the fact remains, isn't it, that some Christians give beyond their means, some Christians give according to their means, but I'm afraid some Christians are just plain mean. They give according to their meanness. How enthusiastic do we give? But supremely, how spiritual is our giving? That's the challenge of these Macedonians, isn't it? First, they gave themselves to the Lord. Christian giving is not a simple act of charity, such as a humanist might engage in. Christian giving is an act of worship. That's why we include it in our morning service. It's not something we're looking for congratulations for. It's a response to who God is and what he's done for us. No gift is worth the giving, then, unless it is such an act of devotion. In the Old Testament, they would bring no unsanctified gold into the temple. It all had to be consecrated. In the same way, we dare not bring unholy gold into God's temple. We must sanctify it before we offer it. And the sanctification he requires of us is that first we give ourselves to him. For giving is a sign of Christian discipleship, of Christian commitment. Not the grudging, reluctant giving of a Scrooge, not the careless, arbitrary giving of a prodigal. Christian giving is the cheerful, thankful, prayerful giving of a consecrated disciple. And that's the first reason we must give. Assuming we want to be disciples, that is. But Paul has a second reason. He says we must give also because Christian giving is an expression of Christian unity. Now this colours the whole of the rest of the passage, but look particularly at verses 13 and 14 of chapter 8. "Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality." Now, I guess some of us are familiar with the words, "from each according to his ability, to each according to his need." They come, of course, from the pen of Karl Marx, don't they? But many commentators have pointed out how similar Paul's sentiment is here in these verses. "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need." Indeed, some would wish to argue on the basis of these verses 13 and 14 that every Christian should be a socialist. Do you think that's true? Some of you perhaps do. I have to say that though I have great personal sympathy for socialism, I think it is an overstatement to say that you can get that out of verses 13 and 14. It's quite clear that Paul is not advocating Marxism, for instance, here, from one simple observation. He hasn't got a machine gun under his arm. He's talking about a free exercise of Christian charity here, not the compulsory confiscation of wealth by ecclesiastical politburos. Again and again, he stresses, the contributions he was seeking were a matter of totally private conscience and decision. That was how the Macedonians had given. Entirely on their own, he says, they made up their minds. And in 9 verse 7, he says that's how he wants the Corinthians to give. Each man should give what he's decided in his heart, not under compulsion. There's no coercion here, then. Paul is even a trifle embarrassed about applying the pressure he is. Verse 8, I'm not commanding you, he says. Verse 10, my advice is, you see, he's going out of his way to soften any suggestion that he's laying down the law in this matter. Mrs. Thatcher might well wish to argue that what he's asking for here are totally consistent with her capitalist philosophy. Because in a sense he's urging nothing more than that free men should do as they wish with their own property. Having said that there, I think it has to be said that Paul was a socialist in one respect. He believed passionately that Christian believers should not see themselves as isolated individuals. He believed they should see themselves as having a great mutual responsibility toward one another. He may not have believed in communism, but he did believe in communion, the communion of the saints. For him, that wasn't an esoteric doctrine about our relationship with the disembodied spirits of Christians who've gone before. The communion of the saints for Paul was a very practical doctrine about our relationship with the materially needy Christians who are still very much here on earth. In fact, there is a word that Paul uses twice in these chapters which makes that quite explicit, which epitomizes this social awareness in his mind. He uses it in verse 4 of chapter 8, and he uses it again in verse 13 of chapter 9. In both occasions in our translation, it's rendered sharing. The privilege of sharing in the service of the saints. Your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. But the Greek word there is koinonia. One which in many other contexts we would translate as fellowship. Or even communion. That's what the Christian church is meant to be. A fellowship. A communion. A group of people glued together by a common life. And it's clear from Paul's use of the word in these chapters that that Christian communion, that fellowship, had quite definitely got economic implications. Giving for him was not just an individual Christian virtue. It was an expression of our corporate Christian unity. And never more so than when, as in verse 13 and 14, it's offered in a spirit of mutual aid. Look again at those verses. Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. Now, of course, equality is a loaded word these days. So it's important to rid our minds of the kind of preconceptions that automatically attach themselves to that word when we read them, when we read it. If you look carefully at these verses, I think you will see that Paul is in fact not arguing for a philosophy of egalitarianism, although he has often been interpreted that way. He's not in fact suggesting here, is he, a redistribution of property to bring about total economic parity between the Corinthians and the people in Jerusalem. What he's asking for here, if you read him, is a sharing of the Corinthian surplus in order to eliminate the acute deprivation in Jerusalem. It was an equality then in their lack of basic human need that he was campaigning for, not an equality in the absolute standard of living they enjoyed. Put it another way, there's all the difference in the world between Jesus' moral challenge to the man who's got two shirts to give one of them to the person who hasn't got any shirt at all. All the difference in the world between that and the sort of egalitarianism that wants to confiscate a shirt from the rich man who's got 10 shirts in order to give it to the less rich man who's got 8 shirts so they each have 9. It's economic needs Paul wants to eliminate here, not the phenomenon of economic diversity in an affluent society. Further to that, I think it's important too to realize that he's not arguing for an ethic of distributive justice. Although again, against a 20th century background, the verse has often been used to support such an ethic. But in fact, if you read him, Paul is not suggesting here that there is essentially anything immoral about the fact that the Corinthians happen to have more than their brethren in Jerusalem. He's not saying that. In fact, that would only have been the case if the Corinthians' financial advantage was the result of exploitation on their part. And there's no hint of any such thing. Now, in fact, we quickly see when we read the New Testament that there were considerable discrepancies of personal wealth and status in the early church, masters and slaves sitting together around the same communion table, but nowhere in the New Testament do we find arguments that such economic stratification is by definition unfair. So though we may be tempted by our socialist prejudices to try and read back things like egalitarianism and distributive justice into this word equality, I think it's very important that we interpret it in the context Paul sets it. He's not arguing here for either of those things. He's arguing for mutual aid, and he spells that out in verse 14. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality. That's what he means by it. In fact, one commentator suggests the better word might be equilibrium rather than equality, to really get across what Paul's talking about. In the fellowship of the Christian church, he's saying, there should be such a mutual concern for one another that we seek to meet one another's needs out of our superabundance. It works both ways, he tells them. The time may come when the boot will be on the other foot, and the saints of Jerusalem will be taking up a fund to relieve you saints in Corinth, he says. It's not a question of egalitarian political doctrine, nor even, I think, of social justice. It's simply a question of a fellowship, of communion, the family of the people of God functioning as a family. As he says in verse 15, he that gathered much did not have too much. He that gathered little did not have too little. There were boundaries to the prosperity of the people of God, which prevented the poor from being destitute, and which prevented the rich from becoming overweeningly rich and greedy. It's a reference, actually, he says, this verse 15, to the way the Jews in the wilderness were fed by manna from heaven. One of the supernatural aspects of that manna was that you couldn't acquire a surplus of it. Whether you collected frugally or greedily, when you got home, everybody found they had as much as they needed. And says Paul, that ought to be a model for the church's enjoyment of wealth. God gives enough for everyone, but sometimes we have to do a bit of mutual sharing out to make sure nobody goes hungry. And that's what this relief fund, he says, is all about. It's an example of the kind of mutual aid which expresses our unity, our fellowship, the communion of the saints, even if we are rather sceptical about a welfare state. As Christians, we have no right to be sceptical about a welfare church. Now, once again, I think we have to say that this thought is of enormous relevance to us at Eden. Giving is a sign of Christian unity, he says, of fellowship. Some of us here have very considerable salaries. Far more than we really need, even to sustain a quite moderate standard of living. But there are others amongst us here who genuinely find it hard to make ends meet. Some of us are out of work. Not as many as you would find in some parts of the country today, but unemployment is not unknown, even in our congregation here, in prosperous Cambridge. Some of us are one-parent families. Some of us are elderly folk living on a pension. No other source of income. Some of us have simply been called to a job which does not remunerate us very highly. Now, those of us who have big salaries have a responsibility to identify those who are in need and to help them. That's what Paul means by equality. It's not a question of political doctrine. Certainly not a question of encouraging the sort of parasite attitude that socialism at its worst encourages. It's an expression of the fellowship which we ought to feel within the family of God. Indeed, I would go further. It has implications, what Paul is saying here, beyond the walls of Eden Chapel. Because if you think about it, the particular charitable enterprise Paul is talking about here was not Corinthian wealthy people relieving Corinthian poor people. It was about the church at Corinth as a whole being in an affluent context, seeking to relieve the poverty of a church hundreds of miles away, the faces of whom they didn't know. Alien poverty, if you like, poverty that was quite detached and removed from them, except that it was the poverty of Christians. Now that seems to me to be very remarkable, and to be an enormous challenge to us. Those of you who come here regularly will know that here at Eden we feel some reservations, we entertain some reservations about the ecumenical movement in our day. We're disturbed by the lack of commitment the ecumenical movement seems to show towards fundamental Christian truth. It worries us that the World Council of Churches supports such liberal theologies, that it organizes joint services of worship with non-Christian religions, that it generally speaking seems to show far more interest in radical politics than in evangelism or mission. And as a result of that, we've often felt it necessary as a church to stand apart from some expressions of Christian unity, which we felt lacked real biblical warrant and priorities. Now, I don't regret that stand at all. I'm quite prepared to defend it, and often do. But Paul is telling us here in this passage that we mustn't allow our dissatisfaction with the ecumenical movement to prevent us from taking bold initiatives of our own in inter-church cooperation. That's what this fund was. It was an exercise in inter-church cooperation. Giving is one area which is a very obvious place to begin in this field of inter-church fellowship. See, we have enormous financial potential here at Eden. I don't believe the offering we take up every Sunday represents a quarter of what we could give if we were sufficiently motivated. Of course, the question people ask is, well, why should we give more? I mean, we meet our bills, we pay our pastor, we support our missionaries. We don't need any more money, do we? Well, the truth is we don't. Here at Eden, we don't really need any more money. Not for ourselves, we don't. But there are thousands of Christians in this world hampered by lack of funds. They have no pastor, they can't afford to pay him. They have no chapel, they can't afford to build it. Some of them have no food. They can't afford to buy it. Our surplus giving potential is for them. That's why God has given it to us. Do you see how Paul says that in verse 11 of chapter 9? You will be made rich in every way, you Corinthians, so that you can be generous. We owe it, you see, to those who belong to us in the family of God's people, to share with them the good things that God gives us. We owe it to them to look for links with other gospel churches, like the churches of Macedonia and Achaia, to link together, to send funds more effectively to brothers and sisters overseas, many hundreds of miles away from us, like the church in Jerusalem. Supremely, we owe it to the Lord to make our giving people-centered. Of course there are things that we have to find money for, the maintenance of buildings, the salaries of staff, and so on. But there is a far more important ministry of giving, which only begins when you've done all that. And that's the ministry of giving to the care of people. Look how Paul outlines that in verse 12 of chapter 9. This service, he calls it, that you perform, is not only supplying the needs of God's people, but is also overflowing in many expressions of thanks to God. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves, men will praise God for the obedience that accompanies your confession of the gospel of Christ, and for your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. And in their prayers for you, their hearts will go out to you because of the surpassing grace God has given you. Paul uses this word service again and again to describe the charitable enterprise he's talking about. The chief benefit, he says, of this giving as an act of service is that it fosters human relationships within the family of God. Look, he says what's going to happen as a result of your giving. For a start, lots of people are going to be very, very grateful. They're going to be praising God for the way your generosity has helped them. They're not going to have any doubts about the authenticity of your Christian commitment. No, they're going to be praying for you. Praying for you in a way they never would have prayed for you before. Praying out of real heart involvement, he said. Because of this link of fellowship that your giving has provided. Well, that's a marvelous thought. Christian giving is a way we express our Christian unity, our fellowship in the family of God. And it can only be that if we give enough that we can give in a people-centered way, in a care-centered way, in a way that focuses on service for the saints, as well as just maintaining the building. Jesus told a story, I think, to emphasize this. It was a story about a business manager who got the sack from his company. And while he was working his notice, he decided he would write round to all the debtors of the company in these terms. You owe us £100, we'll settle for 50. You owe us £250, we'll settle for half. Forget the rest. The parable of the unjust steward, it's often called. You see what the man was doing, of course. He found himself imminently unemployed. Well, when you're unemployed, you need friends. Anybody who's been unemployed knows that. You need friends around to help you out. Well, what better way of making sure he had plenty of friends in the city by being generous with other people's money? That's what he was doing. Being generous with his employer's money to make sure that when he was out there on the streets, there'd be plenty of grateful people around to give him a hand. Now, of course, Jesus does not applaud the man's dishonesty. But he does commend his shrewdness. He says, make friends for yourself by the way you use your money. Because after all, it's not really yours, is it? It's God's. Just as that steward's money wasn't really his, it was his employer's. And the day will come when that money won't be worth anything anymore anyway, because they don't accept pounds sterling in the banks of heaven. It's foreign currency and the exchange rate is zero. So bank balances won't bless you in heaven, no. But people will. The people you've helped through the way you've used your money here on earth, they can bless you in heaven. They will be there because the relationships that have been forged, the human relationships that have been forged in the way you have spent your money, they last in a way that money itself cannot. So says Jesus in that passage in Luke 16, make friends for yourself by using the money God puts at your disposal so that when that money fails, those friends you have made will receive you into the eternal dwellings. See the logic? Indeed, I think this is what Jesus meant when he talked about laying up treasure in heaven. Did he really think we would each have our little personal sort of bank vault up in heaven? No. Because as he said to the rich young ruler, sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. For the poor will be there in heaven, grateful for you, eternally grateful for you. Not one cup of water given to the least of these can lose its reward. See, Christian giving isn't just a mark of our own individual discipleship. It's a wonderful way to express our Christian unity. But it can only really be that when it's people-centered giving that expands the circle of our fellowship and deepens the quality of human relationships in the family of God. And we have to give quite a lot as a church to get to that point where we can really say we are giving for the service of the saints. Well, finally, and very briefly, Paul has one third reason why Christians should be givers. And it's quite simple. Christians should be givers because of Christmas, he says. Look at chapter 9, verse 15, and then at chapter 8, verse 9. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. These verses are little jewels. that shine all the more radiantly because they're set in such a prosaic argument about giving. Here in verse 9 of chapter 8, we've got a whole sermon, the pre-existence of Christ. Not taught as a novel doctrine, you notice, but just taken for granted. He was rich, enthroned in all the magnificence of glory. And we've got the incarnation of Christ, once again not spelt out in theological detail, but clearly presumed, he became poor. He took to himself something which in all eternity he'd never known before. Poverty. And here too is the grace of Christ, expressed with an eloquent simplicity that's perhaps unrivaled in the whole of the New Testament, so that you, through his poverty, might become rich. That's why he condescended to suffer such monumental humiliation. That's why that manger is there in Bethlehem, to enrich us. This is the grace, the generosity of Christ. This is Christmas. People who understand that that's what Christmas is all about cannot help but be generous themselves. Of course Christmas is a time for giving. It has to be. A time for emulating, no matter how feebly, the grace of Christ, the unspeakable generosity of God's gift. There's a legend, you know, that in the 4th century in Myra in Turkey, there was a bishop, an old man, but very saintly. He wanted very much to show his gratitude to God for the gift of Jesus one Christmas time. So he went to a slum area in Myra, the city, carrying a heavy sack on his back. He knocked on the door of one of the little mud houses there in that slum, and he was greeted by the dirty faces of 3 juvenile urchins. He took the pack off his back and gave to those children a warm woolen robe each. And then he disappeared back to his own home. You know the name of that bishop, don't you? It was Nicholas, Bishop Nicholas of Myra. And the legend of St. Nicholas, though it has been commercialized, as most things about Christmas are these days, still has a beauty about it that teaches us a lesson. He knew the grace of the Lord Jesus, who, though he was rich, became poor. And in his thankfulness, he imitated him. Perhaps that's the greatest reason of all for Christian giving. Oh, it's a mark of Christian discipleship. And don't let it be a neglected grace in your life for that reason. Just as we seek to excel in all the other aspects of our Christian character and walk, let's make sure we excel in this grace of giving too. Yes, it's a terrific expression of Christian unity. No act of service we can do for one another generates such a warmth of Christian affection and breathes such mutual prayer. But supremely, giving is Christmas. Let's remember that when the envelopes come through the letterbox and the collecting boxes are rattled under our noses. Christmas is a time for saying thank you to God for his inexpressible gift. And there's no better way of doing that than by becoming givers ourselves.